Good morning. This is Wendy Bauer reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review. Today is July 25th, 2016. And we will begin with an article from the front page, Dedication Comes to a Head. This is an article written by Tony Reed, Herald and Review staff writer. From Iliopolis, the agony and the ecstasy of brewing good beer gets played out in Iliopolis about every 2 weeks. You may recall the 1965 movie titled The Agony and the Ecstasy, in which Charlton Heston, as Michelangelo, goes through physical and mental torture to carry out the commission of the imperious Pope Julius II, Rex Harrison, to paint the Sistine Chapel ceiling with inspiring biblical scenes. One of those depicts an older but stiff, buff god reaching out an index finger to detonate life into the rather languid finger of a young and equally buff Adam. It's not surprising that those probing fingers are reproduced on a can of Stick Alt, German for secret ale, from the Rhinestone Brewery in Iliopolis. A lot of personal agony went into producing that beer, which, for disciples who worship a good brew, tastes like an angel weeping on your tongue. The agony is supplied by brewery founder and sole employee Joe Reinders, whose production process involves stirring 1,500 pounds of mushy grain mash with a wooden paddle that could propel a canoe. That's a major workout for the ex-Marine turned accountant who started brewing beer commercially in March as a business sideline to pay homage to his passion for good craft beers. And for Reinders, craft means made by his aching hands every step of the way. He brews a new batch about every 14 days and suffers mightily for his liquid artistry in the summer. His brewing operation is a complex alcohol alchemy, but part of it involves 1,000 gallons of water heated close to boiling point while it extracts sugars from grain before being mixed with flavorful hops. Reinders, moving liquids around between vast stainless steel vessels wreathed in steam, can only guess at the internal temperature reached in his brewery that used to be a bar called Habits and Vices. Put it this way, when I opened the door and walked outside the other day, the air temperature outside was at least 96 degrees, recalls Reinders, 36. But compared to indoors, it felt like I was stepping into my walk-in cooler. The brewed ecstasy from all this frothy angst currently runs to 5 varieties that include American wheat, German Pilsner, American Double India Pale Ale, Rye India Pale Ale, and the German Alt style, all distinguished by their distinctive flavors and alcohol punch factors. They also rejoice under catchy names such as Bad Samaritan, Interstellar Storm, and Inherited Memory, the evocative titles fermented with the same intellectual effort that oversaw the creation of the product. You want to get the labels exactly right because they are your self-expression and the hard work you put into the beer, Reinders says. He began his hard work learning curve many years ago as a keen but clueless home brewer, getting it all wrong and producing swill. You buy these kits and there would be directions, 5 steps, and yet it's really 1,000 steps, he says. But I worked really hard at it and I learned. With his home brews morphing from undrinkable to irresistible and getting rave reviews, he found investors willing to toast his entrepreneurial dreams and was busy building the brewery by November 2015. As word spread on the taste bud grapevine, Rhinestone beers began showing up all over the place in cans and bottles, and around here are carried by Friar Tuck in Forsyth and Lock, Stock & Barrel, Decatur Brewer Works, and Donnie's Homespun Pizza in Decatur, to name a few. The splendidly named Uncle Monkey's in Iliopolis, a bar with the distinction of offering a full menu of American and Chinese food, was an early adopter and even has Rhinestone products on draft. Owner Jason Swick says the beer is special. Joe doesn't take any shortcuts, and that is what I like. And he tries and tests at every step of the way, Swick says. He's got a beer to please everybody, and I feel honored that he is based right here in town. And just like Michelangelo, when he finally climbed down off the scaffold and joined the adulatory crowd toasting what his agony had wrought on the ceiling, Reinders lives for the applause of his customers. It's pride, he says, when somebody drinks my beer and tells me how much they like what I've done, and I know I've made them happy. That is an absolute thrill for me. It never gets old. Another beer story from the front page actually comes from Random Lake, Wisconsin. Random Lake plant finds success in Top Handle Market. Near the southern border of Sheboygan County, a small but fast-growing manufacturing shop now stands as the epicenter for what's become one of the beer industry's more creative marketing tools, the tap handle. Over the past decade, AJS and Associates has been rolling out increasingly elaborate tap handles as brewers seek new ways to stand out in an increasingly crowded marketplace. The plant now manufactures upwards of 500,000 custom-made tap handles a year. Everyone is looking for something unique, something more eye-popping, said Mark Steinhardt, the company's general manager. There's that much more competition for them in the bar, so they definitely want to stand out. The privately held company, which is owned by Reedsburg-based Hank's Craft, recently began construction on a 16,500-square-foot expansion in Random Lake, where it was founded in 1987 and now employs about 45 people. Steinhardt said the expansion comes as they've essentially run out of space for what remains a labor-intensive process involving a woodworking shop, plastic molding equipment, and painting stations. The company's customer list now encompasses some of the biggest players in the brewing industry, including national brands such as Miller Coors, Boston Brewing Company, Lagunitas, and Ballast Point, and regional ones such as New Glarus and Three Sheeps. The tap handles are sold directly to brewers, who then sell the handles to distributors along with kegs of beer. We always like to say the tap handle can sell the first beer. Of course, the beer itself needs to sell the second one, Steinhardt said. Most of the handles are designed in-house and crafted out of hard maple using saws, planers, sanders, routers, and lathes. The company also makes handles using acrylics, metals, and polyurethane, which are then hand-poured into silicone molds. From the design stage to a finished product can take weeks or months, depending on the complexity. About 85% of their products are made in Random Lake, with the most labor-intensive produced in China. Steinhardt said the process has seen little automation because of the custom nature and artistry in what they do, combined with their small production runs. It's a cross between manufacturing and art, Steinhardt said. We get designs that are really out in left field, and we have to scratch our heads and figure out how to make it manufacturable and cost-effective. The business has seen rapid growth as the number of brewers has doubled in the U.S. in the past 5 years. At bars, what was once a handful of draft beers has exploded into dozens and in some cases hundreds. You used to go into a bar and they'd have 3, maybe 4 tap handles, Steinhardt said. Now it's this big thing with all kinds of variety and turnover of that variety. Steinhardt said what used to be the big two, that what was then Miller Brewing Company and Anheuser-Busch, once accounted for about 3/4 of their business. Today, tap handle sales are split evenly between big brewers and the still-growing craft market. Of course, none of it has caught him by surprise. I've been pleased by it, maybe not so much surprised, he said. It's definitely helped our business. And a feature article out of Mattoon by Jared Jarman, a Lee News Service writer. Love of bagel draws fans out. The love of the role drew Ben Hall and so many others to the big bagel breakfast on Saturday. The Mattoon Man headed to the DeMars Center to claim at least one of 12,000 free Lenders bagels on hand. Lenders has had more than 30 years of production in Mattoon. The scorching heat didn't cool the enthusiasm for the breakfast, long a staple of Bagel Fest, which once again filled the seats around the center. Denise Livingston had her first chance in years to attend the Bagel Fest. Currently residing in Daytona, Florida, Livingston hadn't been to the event since 2009. This year, Livingston was able to go because her family reunion coincided that weekend. Livingston also brought a newcomer to the Bagel Fest, Ron Rasmussen, with her from Florida. "She has been talking about it for years and eventually made me come to Bagel Fest," Rasmussen said. "I finally gave in." Rasmussen said while he liked the bagels and that they were free, he was most impressed with the community. "I just like the fact that it gets everybody coming together here to just do something in the community," Rasmussen said. "It would be nice if it wasn't so hot, but it is, and people are still coming out. It is interesting that it is a small town atmosphere here at the breakfast, and when you are walking, people just randomly know each other and are glad to see each other." Jennifer Miller said she attended because of her daughter, Ellie Miller, 8, who had developed a major love for bagels. As the breakfast ended, a line wrapping around the inside waited with bags and boxes to snap up as many bagels as they could take home. Newcomers to the breakfast, Jesse Fraudenthaler and Dan Enge, both of Charleston, came in just in time to grab 12 bagels to take home. An Eastern Illinois University student, Fraudenthaler said it was interesting and surprising to see how big a deal the bagels were to the community. Later in the day, the Bagel Bow Wow contest was popular. Awards were presented in 4 categories: Best Dog Trick, Owner Pet Lookalike, Best Bagel Dog, and Best Good Old Dog. Cammie McDonough of Mattoon with Pepper, a Shepherd mix, took the Best Dog Trick category. Pepper's ability to jump through a hoop won the day. While it took some time to get Pepper to focus on the hoop, the dog eventually did it a couple of times. Karen Pruitt of Mattoon with Belle, a Maltese, won the Owner Pet Lookalike category. Both were wearing cheetah print outfits. Wheezy, owned by Dana Drew of Mattoon, was named the Best Bagel Dog. The Chihuahua, which is the size of a hand, was dressed in a tiny baseball outfit with the theme of Bagel Fest. Take me out to Bagel Fest. Finally, Missy, owned by Kelsa Bartels of Trilla, was named the Best Good Old Dog, which is given to the overall nice dog. Missy is a St. Bernard. And an article out of Normal by Lenore Sabota, Lee News Service writer. Study projects economic impact of wind farms. The state's 25 largest wind farms generate $30.4 million in annual property taxes and $13.86 million in extra income each year for landowners who lease their land to wind farm developers, according to a report released by Illinois State University. The Economic Impact Study, conducted by ISU's Center for Renewable Energy, also concluded the total economic benefit for the life of the projects is $6.4 billion. That impact could grow if Illinois boosts its wind energy production, but the right policies need to be in place, said David Loomis, the center's director and lead author of the report. State energy policy will be key to Illinois' wind energy future, Loomis said. Current legislative proposals could fix the state's renewable portfolio standard and increase the percentage of our electricity coming from renewable energy. That means approving the Clean Jobs Bill, including the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which has been bottled up in Springfield. The federal deadlines on tax credits are ticking, said David Borgia, public policy manager for Wind on the Wires, a wind power advocacy group. Energy has taken a back seat to the budget issue in Illinois. The study noted the Illinois Power Agency Act of 2007 was a key contributor to the rapid growth of wind power capacity in the state, which currently ranks fifth in the country. Illinois could move up to second, behind only Texas, by 2050, according to a report by the U.S. Department of Energy cited in the ISU study. Although other states might be more efficient in generating wind power, Illinois benefits by being closer to the eastern United States, where demand for electricity is growing, the study says. McLean County is the leader in Illinois, responsible for 15.1% of the state's wind capacity, with 546 megawatts, the study said. In addition to tax revenue and money paid for land leases, wind energy also generates jobs. During the construction phase of the 25 wind farms that were studied, 2,573 direct jobs were created, with 226 new long-term jobs during the operational phase. The latter are mostly wind turbine technicians, Loomis said. The indirect economic impact of the projects includes 17,600 jobs and an almost $2.8 billion boost to local economies, and 643 local jobs and $123.6 million a year contributed to local economies, the study concluded. The study was released as part of the Illinois Renewable Energy Conference that took place Thursday at ISU. The conference, in its second year, attracted 275 people involved in wind, solar, biomass, and geothermal energy, as well as energy efficiency efforts and environmental groups. And from the front page, women play catch-up in filling government offices throughout the U.S. Women play catch-up in filling government offices throughout the United States. Hillary Clinton and Mary Thomas have little in common except that they both hope to add to the meager ranks of America's female elected officials come January. You know about Clinton, but probably not Thomas, a conservative Republican, opponent of abortion and Obamacare, former general counsel of Florida's Department of Elder Affairs. She's running in Florida's 2nd District to become the first Indian American woman in Congress. It's no easy task. There is still a good old boys network that is in place, she said, though she insists that a lot of people see the value in having different types of people in Washington. Even as Clinton attempts to shatter what she has called the highest, hardest glass ceiling, other women, such as Thomas, are testing other ceilings. There are many. Women in the U.S. remain significantly underrepresented at all levels of elected office. Historically, we have centuries of catching up to do, said Missy Shorey, executive director of the conservative-leaning Maggie's List, one of a number of groups supporting female candidates. Though women are more than half of the American population, they now account for just a fifth of all U.S. representatives and senators, and one in four state lawmakers. They serve as governors of only 6 states and are mayors in roughly 19% of the nation's largest cities. There has been progress. As recently as 1978, there were no women U.S. senators, and now there are 20. Still, there has been little headway since a surge of women won office in the 1980s and early 1990s. 16 states have fewer women serving in legislatures than in 2005, and 5 others have shown no improvement, according to an analysis by the Associated Press of data from the National Conference of State Legislatures. Advocates say the dearth of women office holders has had consequences. They say women's voices have been muted in local, state, and national discussions of all issues, from climate change to foreign policy, but particularly of concerns important to women and working mothers, family leave, child care, and abortion, for example. They point to instances where women in office have made a difference. Kim McMillan was first elected as a Democrat to her seat in Tennessee's House of Representatives in 1994 when she was 32 years old, a working mother of two children under the age of three. More than once, she was told she couldn't win because she was a woman. She eventually served six terms, rising to become the first woman majority leader, a major accomplishment, expansion of pre-kindergarten education around the state. I felt like I represented people who didn't have any representation, working mothers like me, said McMillan, now the first female mayor of Clarksville, the fifth largest city in Tennessee. Whether a Clinton win in November will inspire a new generation of female politicians remains to be seen. While the election of a woman as U.S. president would be unprecedented, at least 52 other countries around the world have had a female head of state in the last 50 years. Female representation varies significantly around the United States. Six states have never elected or appointed a woman to the U.S. House of Representatives, and 22 have never had a woman represent them in the U.S. Senate. A major problem, activists say, is convincing women to run. We know that when women run for office, they win as often as men do, said Debbie Walsh, executive director of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. The number of women running isn't going up, and so the number of women in office isn't going up. A support network has been instrumental throughout Ellen Rosenblum's career, beginning as a lawyer in Oregon and continuing as she was appointed a state court judge and later during her successful bid for state attorney general. Two of her early mentors were former Oregon Supreme Court Justice Betty Roberts and Barbara Roberts, the first woman elected governor of Oregon. Rosenblum said she worked to pay it forward, helping to build up a statewide group of women lawyers. When it came to deciding in late 2011 whether to launch her first bid for statewide office, that same network was instrumental. I needed women to talk to make sure I was not completely out of my mind to do this, said Rosenblum, who at the time had just retired as a judge. In California, Hannah Beth Jackson had long been active in her community beyond her work as a lawyer and former prosecutor, but it took the encouragement of one of her mentors to convince her to run for state assembly in 1998. Now in the state Senate, she is chairwoman of the powerful Judiciary Committee. And from Decatur, Valerie Wells writes, "Teachers stay busy in classroom during summer. Years of teaching equals a lot of accumulated stuff. Most teachers work in their classrooms during the summer break, rearranging and purging and preparing for the new school year. But when a teacher is changing not only her grade level, but her building and sometimes her whole method of teaching, it's a much bigger job. Sarah Pritz is moving from Durfee Magnet School, where she taught second grade, to Garfield Montessori School, where she will teach grades 1, 2, and 3 in the same room, as Montessori is organized. She's also training in the Montessori method, leaving her with limited time to pack and move. Everyone who knows a teacher knows they'll be asking to help with things, Pritz quipped, as her grandmother, Sally Kriegbaum, her father-in-law, Jeff Pritz, and her friend, Amanda Duckworth, who is a counselor at Eisenhower High School, all pitched in on a recent Tuesday morning. Pritt's daughter attends Garfield, so she is familiar with the method. Normally, training for Montessori teachers is two summers, but because Pritt's accepted the position late in the spring, she hasn't had time to get all her first year's work done. It will take her three summers to complete it, she said. Her classroom and the hallway at Durfee were a wilderness of boxes, which Duckman taped shut and labeled with their destination. Pritz has thousands of books, for example, which will go with her, plus all the little decorations and things that will make the room uniquely hers. You have to make it feel like home, Duckworth said. At Hope Academy, kindergartners have their own hallway and spend their first year of schooling mostly separate from the bigger kids, though they use the common lunchroom. Rita Ellis, who has spent the last 4 years as an instructional coach at Durfee Magnet School, missed the classroom and having her own students, and will teach kindergarten at Hope this year. She taught first grade for 6 years before becoming an instructional coach. She said she thinks she left the classroom too early in her career. I wanted to use all the things I have learned as a coach, and I missed the relationship piece of having my own classroom, Ellis said. A lot of times on the first day of school, you're running around the building trying to make sure kids know where they're going and helping parents drop off, but you don't get that intimate feel that you would get if you were bringing your own students into your classroom. She loved coaching, she said, and she's working on her administrative certificate with an eye to one day being a principal. But more classroom experience will prepare her better for the position. People outside the profession often don't realize how much of their own money teachers spend for classroom decorations and supplies, so teachers collect those things a few at a time over the years, and friends and family often help out. Because she's been out of the classroom for several years, Ellis's colleagues at Durfee helped her gather the things she would need to outfit her room and donated enough books and other items to set her up. And from Decatur, Tony Reed writes, string of cars burglarized. James Ruski woke up after working a 16-hour shift making automotive glass to discover burglars had smashed the driver's window of his car. Ruski was one of more than 12 vehicles reported damaged and broken into early Sunday morning outside Decatur's Timber Cove Apartments complex in the 1700 block of South Country Club Road. A collective damage bill running into many thousands of dollars was left by the culprits, who frequently stole relatively cheap items such as phone chargers. "They got my phone charger and they took a broken phone that was in there," said Ruski, who only moved into his apartment a few months ago. "I don't know if they got my boy's DS, a Nintendo game system. I'm not sure if he left that in the back of the car. If it was there, they probably got that, too." Ruski said he arrived home from his work day at Fuyo Glass America plant near Mount Zion at 2:30 a.m. He awoke about mid-morning and went outside to discover glass fragments all over the place from the smashed window on his 1999 Toyota Solera, along with a card left by a Decatur detective. "I got a $500 deductible on my insurance," he added. "I hope this doesn't cost $800 or $900 to repair, 'cause I ain't got that kind of money." Police continued to investigate the crime Sunday, but a spokesman wasn't available to comment on how the inquiry was progressing. A neighbor of Ruski, Matthew Patterson, said he had heard officers saying up to 15 cars may have been targeted, including Patterson's own 2004 Chevrolet Malibu. A phone charger was stolen from his vehicle after some kind of pry bar had been used to lever the front passenger door apart while the window was forced downwards. That broke the window mechanism, leaving the window stuck inside the door. The door frame metal was distorted by pry marks. "I went out Sunday morning to have a cigarette and had seen cops all around my car, and they told me I had been broken into," said Patterson. "My wife has got a 2016 Jeep, and I'm just glad they didn't get to that." There's a photograph that accompanies this article. Man bending down and looking into his car with broken glass all over the front seat. James Ruski looks at a driver's seat full of shattered glass outside of the Timber Cove Apartments complex. And we will take a short break now and return for the second half of our reading today from the Decatur Herald and Review. Today is July 25th, 2016. Thank you very much. Please stay tuned.